Jerusalem has long been the focal point of the still unsolved problem of Palestine.
There is no Palestine, no Palestinians, there never was, there never will be.
Philistini, ana ishni Philistini.
So let's start out by looking at the relationship between Bedouins and their urban neighbors throughout the late Ottoman period. It would be no exaggeration to say that urban Palestinians had a kind of schizophrenic attitude toward the Bedouin. Listen to how historian Johann Bussow describes 19th century urban attitudes toward the Bedouins. Quote, "Since the advent of Islam, Bedouins have had a special and ambivalent relationship with those Arabic-speaking urban elites who produced most of the sources relied upon by students of the region. On the one hand, urbanites regarded Bedouins as outsiders with the potential to disrupt the established social and political order, similar to other sorts of bandits and nomadic groups, such as Kurds or Turkmen. On the other hand, widespread ideas about the Bedouins as a repository of values associated with being Arab lent them a prestige that went beyond their economic and political significance. Pronounced and persistent urban discourses on the Bedouins oscillate between contempt and admiration." End quote. And so here Bussow is telling us that urban Palestinians feared the disruptive potential of the Bedouins while admiring their customs, values, and their freedom. And it makes sense that urban Palestinians would feel this way about the Bedouins. I mean, on the one hand, many urban Palestinians lived in walled cities and lived knowing precisely who those walls were designed to keep out. Many urban Palestinians had also performed the Hajj under the supervision of armed Bedouins who represented the one thing that stood between them and other armed Bedouins. But on the other hand, the intrusion of colonial powers, of missionaries, of hostile Western consuls into the lives of urban Palestinians helped revive stories of early Islamic heroes who conquered these lands centuries ago or who fought off the threats like the Crusaders and who liberated Palestine in the process. The Bedouins were perceived, in a way, as a repository of that chivalry. I suppose it is not lost on you that in the case of both urban contempt and admiration, the Bedouin are treated as a kind of separate other. And that right there is usually where the story of the Bedouin-urban relations kind of wraps up. But there is another story, and one with a robust paper trail, that paints a very different picture about intercommunal relations. And this story has its origins in one of the most important events in the history of modern Palestine. Now, to tell this part of the story, I need to stop speaking in vague abstractions about groups of Bedouins and groups of urban Palestinians, and I need to start introducing you to some very specific Bedouin clans. And there are two clans I want to focus on in particular. The first are the Benu Sakhr. Way back in the 16th century, Benu Sakhr began their gradual migration out of the Najd region of the Arabian Peninsula, eventually coming to inhabit a wide swath of land on the east bank of the Jordan River. The precise reason for their emergence from the Arabian Peninsula remains a mystery. But one long-held hypothesis is that their movement was a result of a climate crisis that resulted in a depletion of resources in the Nejd region. And we cannot say for sure, but an interesting thing to note is that the Beni Sakhr appeared on the regional scene around the same time that the Ottomans themselves became the regional power. And they became an important part of the Ottoman rearrangement of power. The second tribe I want to introduce you to are the Adwan. Unlike the Beni Sakhr, the Adwan arrived to Palestine's frontier region in the 17th century from Iraq. And according to Noura Barakat, quote, "In the 17th century, two brothers fled Iraq, following caravan routes to Mecca, after a dispute over the murder of one of their relatives. They crossed over the pilgrimage route, entering the fertile landscape of the Jordan Valley, controlled by a group called the Mahdawiyya. For reasons unknown, they stopped in a place called Jebel Samik, in the elevated plains of the Balqa region overlooking the valley. One of the brothers had a son named Adwan, whose name became attached to this new family in the north. By the mid-18th century, Adwan's sons and grandsons had displaced the Mahdawiyya, securing Adwani control over the Jordan Valley and the Balqa Plains, some of the most fertile lands in the north." End quote. Now, aside from the fact that the Beni Sakhr and the Adwan were both nomadic Bedouin tribes, they were different in a myriad of ways that makes them perfect for a compare and contrast exercise. The Beni Sakhr came to dominate a frontier region stretching 775 square kilometers and reared camels as one of their primary sources of income. Their position, stretching across such a wide swath of land, made them one of the premier Levantine Bedouin tribes that the Ottomans regularly relied on for the security of the Hajj. The Adwan, by contrast, roamed in an area one-tenth of that size, and they were much less interested in working with the Ottomans and much more interested in cultivating local trade-slash-extortion relations across the Jordan River in places like Nablus, Al-Khalil, and Al-Quds. The Adwan and Beni Sakhr have a long interwoven history, and it's a history that features its fair share of marriages, betrayals, battles, reconciliations. And so with that in mind, I'm going to take us to one of the most important high points in their story, and in fact, in the story of Palestine as a whole. The final episode of Season 1 crescendoed with the Revolt of 1834, a revolt which saw urban, rural, and Bedouin Palestinians unite in their opposition to Egyptian rule. And I made a big deal about how impactful this moment was in creating a shared moment in the Palestinian collective memory. Well, the 1834 revolt and the cooperation that was necessary to sustain this revolt had a powerful and lasting legacy upon the Bedouin Palestinians. Here's Noura Barakat again. She writes, quote, "The Adwan and Beni Sakhr restored their alliance in the face of a common enemy in the early 1830s, Ibrahim Pasha's campaign and eventual conquest of Syria from Adana to the Hejaz. For the inhabitants of the interior, the most striking rupture of the Egyptian period was the sustained presence of an army that ranged in size from 25,000 to 90,000 troops. This army required transportation, food, lodging, and men, resources that Ibrahim Pasha increasingly tried to find in Greater Syria rather than transporting from Egypt. Ibrahim Pasha's forces targeted the Beni Sakhr, beginning in 1832 as part of their attempt to requisition camels for the army. The Beni Sakhr rejected this new role outright and sustained multiple military attacks in the 1830s. The Adwan and other communities came to the Beni Sakhr's aid, and the Dyab al-Adwan, that's one of the Adwan chiefs, spent most of the decade in prison in Homs, north of Damascus." End quote. Now, She goes on to say, quote, "The Egyptian moment was transformative because of the widespread and collective rebellions precipitated by intrusive tax collection and, especially, attempts at conscription. Tax revolts had already escalated around Syria in the 1820s, but conscription added a new layer of frustration, especially among village-based cultivators and tent-dwelling Bedouins. During the Egyptian period, a trend of rebellion starting in rural areas and spreading into cities that would continue for more than a century coalesced. In this context, the southern interior regions, especially around the castles of Asalt and Karak, continued to harbor rebel leaders, peasants, and Bedouin fleeing military retaliation. These processes knit house-dwelling villagers and extended hinterland-dwelling Bedouin closer together and created new relations of subordination between villages and Bedouin groups, extracting surplus in exchange for protection." End quote. The revolt of 1834 and the shared threat of Khedival rule bound the Adwan and Beni Sakhr together in a common cause, but it also deepened existing relationships that stretched across the Jordan River between urban, rural, and Bedouin Palestinians. From as early as the turn of the 19th century, the Adwan clan had developed deep personal relations with the Tuqan family of Nablus. One of the Adwan chiefs, Nimr al-Adwan, and the very powerful Musa Tuqan formed a close personal bond. Now, another branch of the Adwan family formed equally deep ties with the Abdul Hadi family, one of the arch rivals of the Tuqans. And throughout the 1850s, these urban-rural alliances were put to the test in the violent civil wars that unfolded in the mountains of Nablus. Well, while all of this unfolded, and for reasons outside the scope of this podcast, the global price of grain began to skyrocket. And Palestinians, inhabitants of a land rich in grain production, found themselves well-positioned to profit from the upswing in the grain market. In the Palestinian collective imagination today, figs, olives, and oranges all play pretty prominent symbolic roles. But in terms of the sheer volume, wheat was the dominant crop of late Ottoman Palestine. A missionary traveling through Gaza's hinterland in late Ottoman Palestine described it as such. Quote, "Wheat, wheat, a very ocean of wheat." End quote. But perhaps the most beautiful description of late Ottoman Palestine's wheat fields comes from another missionary source. And just listen to this. Quote, "A thousand reapers, gleaners, and carriers were abroad and busy when the morning sun shot its first rays down through the olive trees upon the animated groups. The wheat and barley grew among the olive trees, which half hid, half revealed the merry harvesters. Men, women, and children, the first reaping, the second gleaning and guiding the loaded camels. The children at play are watching the flocks and herds, which were allowed to follow the gleaners. But no description can reproduce such a tableau. It must be heard and enjoyed to be appreciated." End quote. With such beautiful descriptions available, it's a shame that the role of wheat harvesting has failed to make it into the collective memory of the Palestinian people. Anyway, Palestinian merchants analyzed their landscape and noticed that just over on the other side of the Jordan River in the Balqa Highlands were large parcels of rain-fed land that would be perfect for grain production. The Abdul Hadis, the Tuqans, and others from Nablus, leveraging the bonds of trust that existed between them and the Adwan, financed the cultivation of land in Adwan country east of the Jordan River, The Abdul Hadis in particular made substantial investments in the development of flour mills throughout the region. The Adwan, for their part, provided the labor and the security and ensured that cultivation and relevant payments would be made on time. Just a few kilometers south, the Abu Jaber family of Al-Quds was engaged in nearly identical transactions, but in their case it was with the Bani Sakhr, and they produced a very similar arrangement in the Jordan Valley. And throughout the Hamidian era, many other Palestinian merchant families would follow suit and begin to establish an economic foothold in Palestine's frontier lands in full cooperation with the Bedouin. One of the most interesting things about these relationships between urban and Bedouin Palestinians is the fact that there was no Sharia court established in the Balqa Highlands until 1869. And until the 1860s, there was barely an Ottoman state presence to speak of. That means that for decades, urban-Bedouin relations operated entirely based on trust, predictability, and mutual expectations of rational behavior. All things that we have been led to believe were absent among the unruly Bedouin. Well, as surprising as urban-Bedouin relations have panned out to be, the relationship between the peasants and the Bedouins has proven to be even more remarkable. In a few episodes, I plan on doing a deep, deep dive into peasant life in late Ottoman 19th century Palestine, in much the same spirit as these episodes and the way that they relate to the Bedouins. So I won't dwell too much on the intimate details of peasant life just yet. What I will say is that most of the literature that exists, even pretty current stuff, characterizes Bedouin life and peasant life as a zero-sum game, a never-ending conflict between the desert and the sown. And look, you don't have smoke without at least some fire, right? Peasant architecture, much like urban architecture, reflected a fear of Bedouin raids. And such a thing would not be necessary without some past experiences, right? I mean, here's historian Rosemary Sayegh. She writes, quote, "The village revealed its defense function in its position and layout. The frequency of foreign invasion and Bedouin raids, as well as the danger of malaria in the plains, made the peasants choose hill positions for their villages." End quote. She goes on to say, quote, "Unlike many villages in the Mediterranean area, those of Palestine were not walled, but the clustering of their solid, stone-built houses in close formation, with the walls almost a meter thick and flat rooftops from which lookouts could be kept and stones hurled, made them a formidable obstacle to most attackers." End quote. So, again, villages would not have had this kind of defense in mind were it not for a legitimate fear of marauding Bedouin. In places like Merj ibn Amir, a valley between Jenin and the Galilee, Ruth Kark has this to say about the relationship between the nomads and the peasants. Quote, "Nomadic tribes would come a few times a year for relatively long periods, with significant effects on the economy and settlement." She then begins to list some of these effects. She says, 1, destruction of crops to the point of preventing the harvest, and 2, looting raids and collecting protection money, which radically depleted the farmers' sources of sustenance. End quote. In the 1850s, James Finn, the famous British consul in Al-Quds, makes a half-hearted attempt at identifying the diversity among the nomads of Palestine. Now, having met with several large and small tribes in Merj ibn Amir, he concluded that the relatively large tribes, like the Adwan and the Bani Sakhr, were always easier to deal with than the smaller Bedouin tribes, who were, quote, "more troublesome to deal with, more given to petty pilfering, and not so easily brought to account." End quote. So for the sake of intellectual honesty, I think it is important to acknowledge that violent conflict between nomadic and peasant Palestinians is part of the story. But it certainly is not the whole story. If you zoom out a bit, you begin to see that the picture is a little more complex. In much the same way that there is evidence of violent confrontation between Bedouin and peasant communities, there is also evidence of violent cooperation between the two. Take this story, for example. When the Adwan tribe first arrived east of the Jordan River in the 18th century, the region surrounding the town of Assalt, which is just east of the Jordan River, was dominated by a Bedouin clan known as the Mahdawiyya, a tribe who, by that point, had come to completely dominate and subjugate the local population. The Adwan had already come into conflict with the Mahdawiyya before, and they saw an opportunity to unite with the local peasants in a pretty spectacular way. Listen to this. Quote, in Adwani oral histories recorded in the 19th and 20th centuries, the opportunity to displace Mahdawi leaders from the Jordan Valley came in the form of a peasant revolt. A prominent Mahdawi leader, Jawda al-Mahdawi, had reportedly been exacting egregious amounts of revenue in agricultural products and animals from the cattle and vegetable farmers in the Jordan Valley. The situation became untenable when Jawda al-Mahdawi, both humiliated men who had come to perform annual labor on his estate and tried to marry a woman from the village of Fuhais near Assalt in the hilly region of the Balqa overlooking the valley. The aggrieved cattle farmers and desperate Fuhaisis knew that Adwan men had recently lost a relative in a violent fight with Jawda al-Mahdawi, and they went to them for help. Adwan's grandsons used this opportunity to unite the Adwan and the villagers against Jawda al-Mahdawi, staging a bloody celebration for the marriage in Fuhais, at which an Adwan surprise attack took down much of the Mahdawi leadership. The Mahdawiyya scattered in the region of Baysan, west of the Jordan Valley, migrating as far as contemporary Lebanon. End quote. All right, so that red wedding style takeover is a pretty dramatic example of Bedouin peasant cooperation. But there are also plenty of examples of more mundane day-to-day examples, right, of how the peasants and the Bedouins coexisted peacefully. Not everything is that dramatic. In the 1850s, when urban Palestinians like the Abu Jabirs and the Tuqans and the Abdul Hadis began investing east of the Jordan, many peasant Palestinians followed suit and began to work in the wheat fields of the Balqa Valley, and only went back east of the Jordan when they were forcibly removed by the Ottoman authorities. There's more on that later. As for the Fallahin who remained west of the Jordan River, the reality is that they depended on the Bedouin for some of their most essential needs. For all peasants, the Bedouins were their primary source of two commodities, meat and coffee. So predictable relationships of mutual benefit must have been at least as common as violent confrontations. The Bedouins, too, I mean, many of them were semi-sedentarized at this point, depended on peasants to work lands that they wanted to cultivate. I mean, here's a beautiful description from a Christian missionary traveling through Gaza's hinterland in the late Ottoman era. He says, quote, "We traversed a beautiful rolling land in whose red soil wheat studded with white daisies grew thickly. The land here, being close to the dry Negev, belongs to wandering Bedouin. But on the hilltops, small houses are scattered about, the homes of Fallahin servants who till the land for their wandering masters. End quote. So, as far as Bedouins and peasants are concerned, we have conflict and cooperation. The peasants needed the Bedouins for essential goods, and the Bedouins needed the peasants for their work and knowledge of cultivation. And I could just end the episode here, but I don't think that would be fair. You've been listening to me for this whole time, and you deserve to be left with something big. Well, the most amazing, the most remarkable, the most mesmerizing example of rural Bedouin cooperation takes us to a place that I have spent almost no time discussing in this podcast, and that is El Khalil, known in English by its Hebrewized name, Hebron. And the origins of this story take us once again to the 1834 revolt against the Khedive of Egypt. For much of the Ottoman era, El Khalil could really be described as a pretty peripheral urban center. El Khalil was not an economic powerhouse like the city of Nablus, and its inland positioning did not give it the commercial potential of a Yaffa or a Haifa. Now, the city itself was famous for hosting the burial place of the Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam, and that site was venerated by both Muslims and Jews. But since the site was not frequently visited by Christians, it didn't benefit from some of the economic prosperity that came with Christian religious tourism in the late 19th century. But the flip side of all of this, and this is very significant, is that its peripheral status made it one of Ottoman Palestine's most autonomous towns. Now, like many other 19th century towns, El Khalil was dominated by powerful families. And the most powerful family by far was the Amr clan. Now, the Amr clan, as well as their rivals, the Amlas, were the descendants of Bedouins who had sedentarized in El Khalil. I mean, precisely the kind of Bedouins that I alluded to in that earlier episode. Now, in 1834, when urban and rural and Bedouin Palestinians rose up to confront the Khedive, the chief of the Amr clan emerged as one of the premier leaders of the anti-Khedival revolt. And his name was Abdurrahman Amr. When the Ottomans managed to oust the Khedive and return to Palestine in 1840, Abdurrahman Amr celebrated by appointing himself as the governor of El Khalil. Now, it appears as though the Ottomans were willing to live with this self-appointment for a time, until 1846, when the Ottomans finally came in as part of their early attempts at centralization, and Abdurrahman Amr had to be deported along with several other local leaders. And so that should be the end of the story, right? Wrong. In 1848, a mere 2 years later, Abdurrahman Amr returns, reinstalls himself as the town's leader, imposing his will and taxing the population as he saw fit. So in 1852, 4 years after his return, the Ottomans apprehend Abdurrahman Amr again. And this time, they have him imprisoned in Al-Quds. But like I said earlier, the 1834 revolt, it built long-lasting bonds that transcended both social class and even geographic boundaries. I mean, Abdurrahman Amr utilized these bonds, the bonds that he built with the notables of Al-Quds, to orchestrate an escape. And he relied on his Bedouin allies to evade capture. Now, this brazen escape saw him once again return to Al-Khalil. And upon his arrival, he had the Turkish tax collector dismissed and immediately began collecting taxes himself. This led to a pretty humiliating situation where Abdurrahman Amr would hold court in his home while the Ottoman official barricaded himself in his residence By 1853, the Ottomans, they grew tired of the situation and they sent in troops to apprehend Abdurrahman Amir. But he managed to escape again, this time to Beirut, returning shortly thereafter to the outskirts of Al-Khalil. Now, in 1855, now we're on the eve of the second Tanzimat reforms, and the Ottomans were really disinterested in the kind of autonomous rule that in past centuries would have been kind of normal. And so the Ottoman governor, Kamil Pasha, orchestrates this massive show of force slash shakedown of Al-Khalil. In response, Abdurrahman Amir, still in the outskirts of Al-Khalil, mobilizes his peasant militias along with his Bedouin allies, launching an all-out assault to retake Al-Khalil, besieging the city in the process. And here's one historian's account of what happens next. Quote, Kamil Pasha set out for Hebron, Al-Khalil, on the 22nd of July, 1855, with 300 regular infantry men, the available Bashibuzuk, those were Ottoman irregulars, and four cannons. When he arrived in Hebron, Kamil first ordered the sheikhs of the surrounding villages to come up to his camp. The sheikhs of three villages refused to obey and declared that they would only pay their taxes through their local leader, Abdurrahman Amir. End quote. Abdurrahman Amir, at the peak of his powers, a power that was rooted in urban alliances, Bedouin support, and peasant loyalty, famously asserted, quote, Abdul Majid may be the Sultan in Istanbul, but I am the Sultan here. End quote. And you know what? He was right. At that moment in 1855, Abdurrahman seemed unstoppable. But Kamil Pasha, the Ottoman governor, had heard enough. He launched his assault on Abdurrahman Amir and his forces that left almost 24 dead and 70 captured. But again, Abdurrahman Amir evaded capture, escaping once again into the safety of his Bedouin allies across the Jordan River. In Abdurrahman's absence, the Ottoman governor Kamil Pasha declared him a fugitive and began consolidating control over Al-Khalil, collecting taxes and taking pledges of loyalty from local sheikhs. A subsequent period of quiet returned to Al-Khalil and the surrounding areas for the next 4 years. But then, once again, Abdurrahman Amir returns in a manner that proves to me that he was even more cunning and resourceful than his story lets on so far. In May of 1859, the Ottomans installed a new governor over the region named Thuraya Pasha, who you may remember from the just one of the earlier episodes. He was the short-lived governor of the province of Palestine. Abdurrahman Amir assured Thuraya Pasha that only he had the power to effectively tax the population. So here we see Abdurrahman Amir using diplomacy and not brute force. And so Thuraya Pasha appointed him as Nazir, a kind of chief tax collector. And having confronted the Ottomans now for 25 years, Abdurrahman Amir successfully returned to Al-Khalil once again. But this is where the problems begin to become insurmountable for Abdurrahman Amir. The reality is that he was only appointed as the chief tax collector under the condition that he could meet certain tax collection requirements. Now, unfortunately for him, he could not squeeze the peasantry any more than they were already being squeezed, and the territory that he once ruled over like a sultan was now in open revolt against him. And now, firmly in the driver's seat, the Ottomans had Abdurrahman Amir exiled to Istanbul, while Thuraya Pasha disarmed the peasants. something that I spoke about at length at the end of season 2. And once the peasants were disarmed, Abdurrahman and the entire Amr clan would never recover. Abdurrahman would continue to be a thing of legend for years, but he would never again threaten Ottoman rule in Al-Khalil the way he once did. The cooperation between peasants and Bedouins in Al-Khalil remained a fact of life long after Abdurrahman Amr. Decades later, in 1877, when the Amr family's Bedouin allies found themselves feuding with other Bedouins, it was the Amr family and other peasants who were called in as auxiliary fighters, not the other way around. Now, the power dynamic may have changed, but the bonds that traced all the way back to the 1834 revolt, those remained intact. And so there you have it. For the remainder of this season, in fact, for as long as I continue doing this podcast, the Bedouins will remain a central part of this story. Their conflicts and cooperation with rural Palestinians, with urban Palestinians, and the Ottoman state will play a decisive role in determining everything that comes next.